Get ready for the O'Shelly effect.
I'm a big fan of the show.
Chuck O'Shelly, and he's been known for many years as a blind JFK researcher specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassinations, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media.
Chuck O'Shelly! Yeah!
Well, that is who I am, and it is the fifth day of August 2019, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar, and this indeed is the O'Shelly Effect, which originates from the facilities of O'Shelly.com, but is also heard in a variety of other places. We do welcome you to the show, no matter where it is you are and when it is you're deciding to hear it, even if it is further on down the stream via your fondle slab of choice, your applicable application, etc. So that is the way it is for this Monday. Now, last Monday, I had a discussion with Professor David Beto. Now, in emails and everything else, I said that night, I'm going to call you Professor Dave. And now all of you guys in emails and everything else are calling him Professor Dave. So Professor Dave is back with us. Now, there was one email which did complain. Why did you not reach out to the co-author of the book? Because generally speaking, quite frankly, I don't always reach out to the co-author of a book. I just get one of the two authors of a book on, and I talk to them, and I had already talked to David about this, so therefore that is why, but I thought also it was a good point. So, guess what we did? We have Professor Dave back with us, and Professor Beto with us, who happens to be his wife. Now, funny thing, I did not, and this is going to sound really, really strange, but, there was a relative point that was brought up back and forth between myself and Professor Dave in emails this week, which I found really fascinating and didn't consider the first time around. It's funny. There's a secondary graphic which I put together, which has the two of them standing on a stage giving a presentation. And I remember looking at the graphic and thinking, gee, it's interesting that these two are in a relationship together. What is it like when two PhDs live with each other? I have never experienced a situation where I have been in the in a marriage with an intellectual equivalent to myself. So I found it really weird and was thinking about that, not even bothering to consider, by the way. Also thought to myself, she's actually not that much shorter than him in the picture. I was just thinking to myself, you know what? I don't know. At a glance, she looks a little more intelligent than he does. And all these different thoughts, slapped together the graphic, put it out there. You know what I didn't consider, which, again, was in the exchange between myself and Professor Dave, is that she's a black woman, too. That was, like, not even my thought. And it is relative. It is relevant. Excuse me, not relative. It is relevant to the discussion about the book that they co-authored for a few different reasons, I think, but is not going to be the major focus, although I'm going to address it right away. But before I do that, we're going to go back into this discussion about T.R.M. Howard, which, again, I'm very glad that more than one listener, certainly a handful of you, wrote to me and told me that you were totally unaware of this man. And he is an interesting figure in American history. First of all, even if he was not black, he's an interesting figure in American history as far as I'm concerned. But extremely fascinating, not only because of his connection to the Emmett Till case, which we talked about last time, but for a variety of reasons. And really just a remarkable individual who is, well, although recognized in some circles, in some studies, whatever, I've taken various courses on African-American history, and his name doesn't even come up. You know, and I think that's a travesty. Given what it is I've been able to learn through the book, which Professor Dave and Professor Beto, which, yes, they're both named Beto, but just for the sake of conversation, Professor Beto and Professor Dave did both co-author. So, first of all, you know, let's welcome back Professor Dave. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great, and I have to admit you're right. I definitely married up.
Listen, I don't mean to be mean or anything. You're a great guy and all, but at a quick glance, I don't know what it was. I just said, you know, I think she is more intelligent than him. I don't know why that is. I had this feeling. And it's not a bad thing. I mean, listen, if you're a genius and your wife is a super genius, it's not a problem. You know, the way I see it. But that's just, you know, the way it struck me. And I don't know why. And I just left it at that and was imagining what the dynamics of that relationship were like. And that was all the thought I gave it. Did not consider her race in the equation. I don't remember why. It just wasn't like part of the, well, you know, it's great. I've got one author. And then you brought it up and said, you know, this would actually be a relevant point when it comes to the research. And I said, you know what? That's right. Especially because, well, she's a professor in the South as well. And with that, Professor Beto, you know, I know I've been talking about you a bit, and I know it sounds a little jokey, but I'm serious. That was my thoughts when I had not spoken to you all the way up until today, actually. And I had just spoken to Professor Dave there, and, quite frankly, I wasn't ignoring you. I want you to know that. It was just sort of like, well, I've got the one author. That's okay. And, really, really happy to have you along, though, to get your perspective. And also, according to him, you know, since he married up, I've got the smarter Professor Beto. So plus for me this time. How are you doing tonight?
Good evening. So glad to speak to you.
Yeah, well, look, I'm very, very happy to do this. And certainly, you know, I'm not trying to make you feel uncomfortable. I'm just being honest about what I saw. And also, I want to make sure that everybody takes a look back at that graphic and the ones that I'm going to put out tonight, along with the show and the links, because you can follow up just like you did last time. Of course, we'll put in again exactly where you can get the book, not only from the publisher if you like, but if you want the Amazon link, I recommend you buy it from the publisher. I don't know. Is there a preferred place? Either one of you can answer this. I it doesn't matter. Is there a preferred place you'd like them to go to get the book on TRM Howard?
Well, our publisher is the Independent Institute. And I think they're fine with you ordering it from them, or you're just ordering it from Amazon. It might be the easiest thing to just do it from Amazon.
Could be, but I'm not exactly a fan of Amazon. So I give you both links, guys. The Independent Institute, which also just started following me on Twitter. You can follow them on Twitter. Maybe I'll give you guys that link. Just wanted to let you know. But anyway, I did not attempt to discount, because I got this one email, which was a complaint, as if I was purposely ignoring, Linda, by the way, is her first name. But Professor Beto, I was not ignoring you. I want you to know that wholeheartedly that you were not being ignored in the equation as far as the book being written, at all. It's just, again, I had already had dealings with Professor Dave, so therefore I went with him first. But really glad, like I said, to have you along. So, David, where should we go with this? We definitely covered the Emmett Till case last time. We briefly mentioned, TRM Howard's relationship to Medgar Evers, and I advise you guys go take a listen to last Monday's show to catch up on all of that. But really, we didn't even scratch the surface of the remarkable history of this man. So maybe you should sort of set the stage for where we're going to go next. There is a history previous to where we picked up in Mississippi, which is kind of where we started last time, and again, another history which we only gave a nod to regarding Chicago, and obviously, feel free to direct us all to Professor Beto, your wife, in this case, where her area of specialty would be even better to hear from. So yeah, if you wouldn't mind getting us started, sir.
Well, just to review, Dr. Howard was born in 1908. He died in 1976. He was a major civil rights figure, a major professional figure among African Americans. He knew all the principles. In fact, he really gave a lot of these people their start, like Fannie Lou Hamer, Medgar Evers, and he was instrumental in really Jesse Jackson's rise. Howard always stood out wherever he lived. So definitely the culmination of his career was the Emmett Till case. But before that, he had a really fascinating history. He grew up in Murray, Kentucky, which is in western Kentucky. And the year of his birth was a time when there was massive violence going on. There were these people riding around near Murray. In fact, they planned to attack Murray, these night riders, which basically were working to some extent for small tobacco growers who were trying to compete with the big companies. But there was very much a racial element, and they would go into towns and, you know, essentially drive out the whole black population and killed many of them. So this was happening at the very time he was born. In fact, they planned an attack on Murray that they that kind of fell apart at the last minute the month he was born. And in that area of Kentucky, there were lynchings going on all the time. And sometimes we have a stereotype of lynchings as though they just, you know, they hang the person from a tree. These were lynchings, and this was very common, where they would literally burn people at the stake. They would burn them, and you know, when they were still alive. And people would, after the lynching, would collect souvenirs. So this kind of thing happened all around Howard during his childhood. In one case, there was an attempted lynching. It almost came off, where there was a friend of the Howard family who was accused. And what he was accused of basically was killing a deputy sheriff, and the deputy sheriff deserved it. You know, the deputy sheriff was harassing his wife and following him around. And finally, he fought back killed him. And that lynching had to be stopped by the governor of the state, who came to Murray to stop it. And again, Dr. Howard witnessed all of this. So he grew up in that kind of atmosphere.
So this is his early years. And meanwhile, I want to make a point to the audience, which you politely skipped over. And I hate to do this, absolutely, but let us be realistic about the history. When you said collecting souvenirs, I want the audience to recognize that that included collecting pieces of the individual that might have been torn apart or cut apart or whatever. I'm not going to go into complete graphic detail of it, but I want to make that point clear, that was considered a souvenir, okay? When you talk about the brutality of what was done. So again, you know, I'm at a loss for words to do this without getting graphic or. I don't know. It's difficult to describe horrible things without saying horrible things. Okay, but that is the reality that I do want you to wrap your mind around when Dr. Beto's saying this. Now, there might have been other souvenirs too, where somebody might want a piece of the rope in this as well. But I didn't want that skipped over without it being recognized what it was you were talking about. Is there any anything incorrect about what I just said, Professor Dave?
No, this is Linda speaking.
Oh, Linda, yes.
A piece of rope sounds really mild, but we're talking about teeth and bones. So let's be, I guess, clear about it and straight when we talk about souvenirs. We're not talking about rope. And when we talk about the time that Howard not only was born in but also lived, one of the things that really said a lot to me is that he was born poor. And for him to have been born poor in Kentucky and to become probably one of the richest African Americans in Mississippi at the time, we went to the courthouse to see just with him selling his property and that kind of thing, if he actually was a millionaire, and indeed he was. But one thing that struck me as a child, his mother was such that she told him, she got a gun and maybe three bullets and told him to bring supper for the evening. Do not shoot at the quails because they're too small. Bring either rabbits or squirrels. And it was then that he became an absolute crack shot, a very good with the gun. And I know in our day and time, we cannot imagine people being that poor that they send a child out to what gather food for the family. So again, he was indeed a remarkable man.
Well, right, and as we discussed in the earlier program, he winds up becoming a game hunter of sorts, but this is where the history begins, is as a child he's gathering food. Now, the other point I want to make there is, yes, I'm aware that we were talking about body parts. I don't know if you heard me say that, but literally pieces of the body, like you said, bone and teeth, would be included, but I do know that pieces of rope had actually been sold. As bizarre as it sounds, I've seen the sales of this kind of stuff in other parts of the South as souvenirs, where you know where that was also part of it. But the other thing that you mentioned there is very clear and very straight, and I think that was needed to be mentioned as well. But let us move on to this remarkable man and get outside of the ugliness which. Well, he had to be surrounded by at this particular point in time, because that is exactly where he was. So you're talking about a family, yes, that would require a larger animal, you know, get what it is you can get. And a rabbit would be much more suitable to feeding more than one person than the smaller birds and things like that. So it's do you know at what age he first started doing that, like how old he was?
Oh, I think I've seen it recounted, but he's you know, he'd be under 10, maybe 8, 9 years old. He's doing that kind of thing. And she would actually give him certain number of shells and said, you're not getting any more than this, so you better hit your mark. So the pressure was, you know, because they couldn't afford to buy a lot of shells.
Right, so out of necessity, you know, his skill was born out of necessity, basically. That would be the way to look at that.
Absolutely.
Mm. Well, and a lot of things become born out of necessity when, you know, they often say that heroes are not, you know, people who volunteer for the job. They are created because they were cornered. I forget where I first heard that phrase, but, you know, this is where... You know, your character is built is on these particular circumstances. So, anyway, continuing on, as we were saying, you know, for the background and as a child and everything, perhaps Linda, if you don't mind, if you would like to illustrate a few more pieces of the early years for people, I would really love to hear that. Because, again, last program we sort of started with, well, here's his education and how he became a doctor, but we really didn't focus on his much earlier years so much.
Well, as a child, his mother worked in a hospital, and he started to work as well in the hospital. He started in the kitchen, and he'd sweeping and mopping and then cooking. And so the thing that set him apart was that he not only worked hard, but complete, and he would do more than was expected of him. And so Dr. Will Mason recognized that ability and that, I don't know what it is, it's personality maybe. And so he decided to help him. And what he did was he ended up paying for his college for him to come to Alabama, for the first round at Oakwood in Huntsville, Alabama.
Let me say that Will Mason was of tremendous help to Howard, his white doctor in Murray. However, Howard also worked his way through school to a great extent as well. He was the kind of guy that was a real, you know, go-getter. He was Seventh-day Adventist at the time, and he would go and sell books. He'd sell anything. He was very good at scrounging up money in very tight situations. But certainly this white doctor helped him and asked him questions and said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he said, I want to be a doctor. So he gave him all of these jobs in the hospital, and Howard just came through with flying colors.
Mm. See, and again, that is very much something that could be attributed to his work ethic, I think, would be the thing here. It seems as though when given a task, whether he's a kid being handled a couple of shells, or he's being given a what most people would consider a menial labor job at a hospital, either way, apparently his ethics when it comes to his work were apparent and stellar and could be observed by other people. So this this is likely what made him stand out in the first place, but seemed to be something that he continued on with throughout his life, because in every one of these accounts that we covered last time as well, you see a man who does not let go easily, who does not seem to give up easily despite the odds against him, the trouble that could be had for what he's doing. And it seems as though that was very much formed in his early years. So this is something to consider throughout the rest of the story, I think. Now, at this point, he goes to medical school in Alabama, and we talked about that, but he also goes on to other education, right?
Well, he goes to it's not a medical school, it's Oakwood College, which among its alumni was Little Richard many years later, which is a black Adventist, kind of almost sort of, I guess at the time, was sort of almost like a junior college. And then he went on and went to school in Nebraska at another Adventist school called Union College. He was the only black student there. And then he gets his degree at a school now called the Loma Linda University. So he actually went to medical school in California.
Okay. Well, no, I'm glad you straightened that out, because, well, obviously you go to a college, you know, before you go to medical school, right? So it does take a while to make a doctor, no matter what era you're in. So you do have to go to other school before you go to medical school as well. But a lot of years of school, sounds like. I mean, you know, and that's a lot going on for just about anybody. And like you said, it's interesting that he's not only working through, but also has the assistance of the doctor and all that. Now, I found it also remarkable that he decided to go back down south where he knew exactly what the atmosphere was like. Do we have any insights as to exactly why he chose to do that and maybe not go elsewhere?
Well, I think so. He heard that they had built this hospital in Mound Bayou, Mississippi. Mound Bayou, Mississippi is an all-black town started by blacks shortly after the Civil War. And at the time, and still now, they've had black mayor, chief of police, black officers. So initially, when Mound Bayou started, blacks that were in trouble or seeking shelter would run to this all-black town in Mississippi for safety. And so this town is now building a hospital. And so Dr. Howard came in as his chief surgeon.
Okay.
And I think it was a chance for him to really have a role where he was, you know, he was sort of in charge. He was going to be able to shape this new thing. And he was working for facilities for the Seventh-day Adventist Church, really controlled, really monitored. And this is his chance to go somewhere and be the chief surgeon and really kind of mold the situation. And, yeah, he didn't like the South. He didn't like the discrimination, but he was used to it. It wasn't unfamiliar to him. And he was able to thrive in any sort of environment. And Mississippi was a very hostile environment, but he was able to thrive there by finding a niche.
Okay. So, but his residency was done, like, what they would consider like a residency was done at one of these Adventist places before he comes in to become the chief surgeon at the new hospital, which is being put together. I guess, you know, it's being built during the time he's in school or maybe the time he's a resident elsewhere. But this is his chance to come in and pretty much, you know, be the one that shapes the institution itself. Which does seem to be something that he is occupied with when he's doing different work. And when he goes into the town there, as we discussed last time, he winds up creating a whole bunch of interesting businesses and, well, not just businesses, but other institutions, it seems like, in that area. So he seems to be very concerned about sort of shaping the trajectory of the community, so to speak. I mean, is that accurate, you think?
Well, I'm sure it is. When I think of him, I think of him as a man with ideas. And not only having these ideas, he thought of himself that we can get this done. And it was something about his personality and who he was that allowed others to sort of embrace him and agree with him and work with him. Because I can't think of her name. Merle Evers. When we interviewed her, she said that when you looked at him and he walked in, you knew he was somebody. And she talked about the way he was dressed and what he did to a room. So not only did he have that quality, he also had the quality of engaging people to work with him, because there's no way in Mississippi he could have accomplished as much as he did without the help of others.
Mm. Well, I mean, that's just a fact when it comes to the building of any community, certainly. But in the very hostile era that the South was in at that time, which, you know, again, let's be realistic about it. This is a unique sort of a circumstance that he comes into, but apparently, by all accounts, the power of his personality was really unique. I mean, you didn't have individuals who sort of carried themselves in such a way that that they did have that sort of a persona. That I've seen this and heard about this when it comes to other individuals who wind up being leaders for one reason or another. They don't have to declare themselves in charge for one reason or another. When they sort of step into a room, you know that you're dealing with someone of substance one way or another. That they have sort of by a strength of their own personality, it just sort of it's just self-evident to everybody who witnesses it. And I think that's probably what and when you're talking about Medgar Evers' widow at this point in time now, you know, that's what she's describing, right?
I think partially, and the reason I say that is when you first see him is how she described him. But as we talked to her and she talked about her engagement with him, the thing about that is this: not only did he appear to be, he actually was, meaning that when he had to be brave, he was brave. When he had to step up, he did step up. And I think that makes a difference, because sometimes we can look at somebody and you have that feeling or that impression, but then sometimes they kind of filter away and they weren't what you thought they were. Mm. But for Dr. Howard, he was everything and some. The bravery he had height, so that gave him a little power, I think, for some of the shorter people looking at him. And not only that, when it came to him going up against, let's say, J. Edgar Hoover, he did not back down. He engaged J. Edgar Hoover and told him exactly what he thought, even if it were not a positive engaged discussion.
And we may be getting a little ahead of it, but, you know, taking on J. Edgar Hoover in 1955-56 was, you know, that was Hoover at the height of his power.
Right.
That was a man who just controlled his public relations. You know, there were movies that came out at that time, right after that, with Jimmy Stewart, you know, the FBI story, radio shows. I mean, Hoover was deified, and Howard did not back down when Hoover attacked him. He hit back hard and got some support and a lot of opposition for doing that.
Mm. Well, no, it's that is an interesting point too, because I mean you're talking about a time period where if an FBI agent would have gotten, you know, headlines or whatever, Hoover would immediately retaliate against his own people for seeming to outshine him, if you will. You know, according to some of the history I've read anyway, that's exactly what he would do. And he certainly, I mean, in my estimation, Hoover was not somebody who, wasn't racist, you know, so, well, why am I trying to be kind? The guy was certainly racist. And, you know, definitely, probably found it, almost, galling to have a black man tell him anything, I think. But, you know, again, these are characterizations I'm taking secondhand here. It's not like I knew J. Edgar Hoover, but it just appears to me as though this would be the case. So, you know, and the fact is that anybody who knew anything knew that J. Edgar Hoover was a powerful individual. So, you know, for somebody to maybe not be on the side of standing up to the man wouldn't necessarily have just made them a coward. It might have made them somebody who was just trying to be strategic or trying to stay alive, because God knows what could have happened to you if you did. So it is a remarkable sort of act of courage to stand up to this man in any way, shape, or form, it seems like to me. But, again, this might be my own prejudices about J. Edgar Hoover coming forward. What do you think?
Well, I think that you're right. Most people probably would have. They would think about their family, the wife and children, and they would not say anything because they would not want retaliation. But the thing about Dr. Howard is this. He was brave. He said what he had to say, and he did not back down.
Another thing he was dealing with on the whole Hoover thing is, Hoover, you know, may have been racist, but he was working with a lot of very important black leaders, and was and some of them were working with Hoover to try to secretly working with Hoover to try to discredit Dr. Howard. So there was a whole network of African Americans who owed Hoover favors, wanted to curry his favor from him, and were willing to basically work to undermine Howard, partly because Howard was not an organization man. He would definitely work with the NAACP, he promoted it, but Howard was Howard, right? He had his own independent base, and a lot of people kind of saw him as a loose cannon. So there were multiple reasons, but there were people that were working with Hoover in the African-American community to undermine Howard.
Mm. And I think sometimes, too, people will have respect for someone who is independent, someone who is honest and straightforward, more so than someone who move with the wind, flowing back and forth and give and take. Howard was usually very direct, very straightforward, and everybody knew exactly what side he stood on. And so I think he garnered a lot of respect in that way.
Mm. No, and I can see that. You know, and this brings up a couple of interesting questions, and I want to get right to this because, as I mentioned at the beginning of the discussion, I still find it remarkable that we're not seeing more of a discussion about this man. That, quite honestly, without your book, I don't see a very solid biography. Yes, indeed, there's a Wikipedia page devoted to the man, and there's, you know, a few online articles that I was able to find that are not tied to the two of you, but not very much. And I don't understand that. I wonder if that is in part due to the fact that he maybe wasn't directly identified with a particular organization on the one hand. And I also wonder if it is because he does not necessarily fit the typical liberal template, because, you know, this was an independent thinker who did not seem to fall in line with a particular agenda except the one that he seemed to think was right, regardless of what the actions that were taking place were. Because he certainly seems to have had an impact not only on the community, but on a great many people whose names we do know very well. And again, I've looked at African American studies on the college level, not the, you know, not the highest of universities, but directly at the curriculums, where I do not see the man's name in there. For basic studies on African American history, I cannot reconcile with myself why that is even a possibility. And actually did not know much about him either. I just kind of knew that he was somebody who was there, sort of in the mix, but was not even close to, as aware of the details of exactly how, relevant he should be when studying what it is we're looking at today. And, you know, quite frankly, more relevant today than ever. We'll leave that there. But, when it comes to the progress, and even lack thereof in some cases that is made, in this place we call America, man. I mean, it's frightening to me that this man is sort of, almost ignored. And I want to get to that with the two of you. And also, this is the point at which I would like very much if Professor Beto, Linda, that is, would address for me what it is like, seeing this figure who should be highly regarded. As far as I'm concerned, why is it that school children are not taught about him in February at the very least, because that would be Black History Month? I never saw him in my studies, and, I was part of that first couple of first couple of years where it was instituted even nationally that during February we had a lot more Black studies in history. Okay. I actually was one of the first people in my school to take the Black history class, which was really kind of strange. I was the only white kid in there. Which was kind of odd, and quite frankly, I don't even like identifying myself as white, but that's the way I was identified then. This man's name does not come up, and I think it's a travesty, first of all. But secondly, if you wouldn't mind speaking to why that is, and what your thoughts are regarding that, both of you, please.
Well, first of all, we were in the Mississippi Delta doing research on fraternal societies when we heard about Dr. Howard. And as professors, when we publish, it's original research. So in order to publish, you have to publish something that lends to the academic rigor, meaning we don't write the same thing everybody else is writing all the time. So again, when we found out about this man, we started look into it, and the more we looked, the more fascinating he became. We found out that Martin Luther King was indeed aware of Dr. Howard and had invited him to Montgomery to speak. So why is it that we didn't know about him? For me, it's simple. Mississippi. You're talking about the Mississippi Delta. In our book, we call it the Heart of the Beast. And you didn't have the television cameras that you had in Selma, when they were marching in Selma and the horses were trampling on the people and using billy clubs and those prod irons and hitting them and knocking them up against walls. You had television cameras broadcasting that all over the United States. That brought the attention to not only Selma, but of course to Alabama. Mm. You didn't have the televisions in Mississippi, so you didn't have the filming. So, of course, Dr. Howard was known because Martin Luther King brought him to Alabama. And even we talk about Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks, we interviewed her, of course, and she said that she was thinking about the Emmett Till case, and she was thinking about Dr. Howard's speech, which was just a couple of days before. So, again, to answer your question, television makes a big difference.
Mm. I think there's other things. I think you hinted at it as well. I think Linda's right that he occurs. He's really there. He's a local figure, and there were these figures in the South. Every state had key Black figures. Georgia had Martin Luther King Sr. was one of the key leaders there.
Right.
And there wasn't really a national network as much as what came later. So that's part of it. But I think also Howard just, like you said, he doesn't fit the mold. Howard likes to make money, right? He likes to dress well. He likes to gamble at the races. So he's not a kind of Gandhian figure, you know, our stereotype of a civil rights leader who's living very modestly.
Or a minister.
Or he's not a minister. And that is actually, in Mississippi, we found that the ministers in the Mississippi Delta were really not major figures among African Americans. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I think because the church there, the clergy is more, have a hand-to-mouth existence in the Delta, going from church to church. They depend on whites to get access to plantations and that kind of thing. So in Mississippi, Howard was really with a lot of peers. The people in his civil rights group tended to be businessmen, professionals, leaders of fraternal societies, and really not many of them were ministers. So he comes from that business background. And again, people don't like that stereotype because part of the civil rights movement in the 60s was sort of a rebellion against bourgeois values, against business values. And there was I saw this tendency of some of these folks to say, oh, the black businessman is an exploiter, a parasite, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, maybe not that explicit, but I saw that kind of thing. And so I think that that's part of what's going on with Howard, why he was ignored, because he just doesn't fit the stereotype of what people want a civil rights figure to be, the people that promote, you know, this kind of history.
And I don't think he was speaking for the NAACP either. Howard was an individual. So, again, he spoke for himself.
Well, allow me to get blunt and nasty about something then, too. Because I think the other objection here, the other reason why he may not have been focused on earlier could have been the fact that he's a little frightening to some people because it seems to me as though, now that this could be my observation and I could be entirely wrong, but quite frankly, I'd like the two of you to address it anyway and correct me if I'm wrong. But it seems to me as though a man who is well, it was mainly men speaking at the time. So, yeah, I'll say men, mainly men that were speaking at that time on behalf of the black community. When you add the element of a firearm into the equation, they become extremely frightening to the rest of the establishment. And I find that a man who says to you, look, I'm not unarmed. I'm not just going to take the beating. I'm not going to do this through nonviolence. If you come at me, I will defend myself. It seems to me as though figures who are part of the civil rights movement at any point from the 60s or the 70s or the 50s, anywhere in that 30-year period, if you add a firearm into that equation, they become almost persona non grata when it comes to teaching them in an academic setting, which is, you know, something that I think prevails to this day. I often complain that I know this is not always a popular sentiment, but I'll say it anyway. The Black Panthers are treated like an equivalent to the Klan, which they are not. Okay, because simply they had firearms. It's that simple. And I feel that that is exactly why it is they are treated as they are treated. And I also feel as though any black figure who spoke up at that time, who said, I will defend myself, was a little too frightening all the way through the 70s for, I don't know, for consumption by, let me just be honest, white America. What do the two of you think of that particular aspect? Because Dr. Howard had, you know, made it known, maybe not, you know, in every corner of the universe, but had made it known that that he was armed and was not going to just take the abuse if it was dealt to him. You know, I would like to have both of you address that and tell me if I'm wrong.
Okay, I guess I'll go first. First of all, when you're talking about blacks, you're talking about a very small percentage of America. So there are very few blacks compared to how many whites there are.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about guns, there's no way a very few can stand against the many and survive shooting with guns. When you mention the Black Panthers, yeah, they were depicted as militant at one time, but the federal government was active in doing that. But one thing that you don't hear a lot about the Black Panthers is they started preschooling and teaching and educating and training children prior to going to the first grade.
Mm-hmm.
And those programs are still in place now in California that the Black Panthers started. Now, getting back to Dr. Howard, how is it then that he had a gun? And how is it that he survived at all? I think, first of all, Dr. Howard did not go around threatening to shoot and kill everybody in Mississippi. What he did was this. He became a crack shot, and he was good at it. But he was in Mount Bayou, Mississippi, all black town in Mississippi. And he had the gun saying, I will defend myself. I will protect myself.
Mm-hmm.
Howard, we didn't talk about his relationships with whites around the Mississippi Delta, but he eventually built relationships with whites there in the Delta. But again, it did get to the point where he feared for his family, his wife, and himself, and he eventually left and went to Chicago.
Hmm.
And I think we can maybe overplay his uniqueness in a certain sense. There's a very interesting book called We Will Shoot Back, which is done by a mainstream historian, which looks at the roles of firearms in the civil rights movement. Rosa Parks slept with a gun under her pillow. Fannie Lou Hamer was armed. Medgar Evers was armed. And if you look at Martin Luther King, in his early years he gave up his gun eventually, but at demonstrations, people around him were armed. There was a group called Deacons for the Defense, which was a black organization of armed security. And I got to believe that they were influenced by Howard. And they were there at those demonstrations providing security. So this is the South, as we said before, a gun culture place, a place where a lot of African Americans own guns. And sometimes you get these pacifist Quakers, whites, going to Mississippi, rural Mississippi, and they'd be shocked by this and wouldn't like to see it. But every African American they encountered in these rural areas just about had guns and mm-hmm. used them and were not afraid of them. And so they ended up sort of having to adapt to that and say, well, okay, maybe this does serve a role for them. Maybe it's an important role as a kind of prevention of possible violence, a deterrence.
Well, right. And as I stated on the program that you were on with me last, I'm in Georgia. Okay. And I know you can tell from my accent, right? I'm in Georgia and, my home is probably the only one I could throw a stone at that doesn't have a shotgun in it. At this moment, that's my choice, but, that's a story for another day. Everybody's got a shotgun. Everybody does. Which is not the same in the rest of the country, and this is not something that just happened last week here. This is part of the culture in the South, generally speaking, no matter who you are. Hunting is a different culture down here than it is up north. I know that factually. I've lived in various parts of the country. So I gotta tell you, it is a unique, thing though. That I think carries through. I mean, Medgar Evers is again somebody who is not even thought of as having a weapon by a lot of people, but he did. And we're not talking about the threat of violence from these guys. We're talking about the willingness to defend themselves, which is why I think a great many people are not necessarily readily celebrated in mainstream recognition. And when it comes to the Panthers, I've gone through great great pains to make sure on this show, even with one of the original Panthers, to discuss the breakfast programs, the clothing drives, the other stuff, the actual roots of the organization, which according to him was about putting in a traffic signal, actually, in a dangerous area there to begin with, in the Bay Area. So, you know, this is a strangely warped piece of history. The federal government absolutely had a program where they wanted certain individuals neutralized. That's actually a word you can quote from some of their FBI files, which Larry Pinkney described on this show quite extensively, as to, you know, his entire case being held as a political prisoner in Canada based on the actions of the U.S. government. And all of that, which, by the way, he won that case with the UN. In case people don't know about it, I'll certainly provide you with a link along with this show so you can take a look at that as well. But back to the subject at hand. So I guess it could be partially due to the fact that, just nobody has unearthed this remarkable history previously. And the two of you have actually done this, which I imagine there's more that could be revealed if people dig further and further. Was he sort of still kind of on a local level, like local historians were more aware of him? Because that's another thing that happens in certain parts of the country where local historians are very aware of significant figures, and the national recognition of them or international recognition of them may not be at the appropriate profile. I mean, is that also significant here in the equation?
Well, let's talk a little bit about Mississippi. Sure. Even though Mississippi has a large number of African Americans living in the state, when you look at the businesses, they're owned by whites. Blacks work in them. They work in the restaurants. They work cooking and serving. They work at the service stations. They work at all of them, but they don't own it. And so when you're talking about why is it that he is not known in Mississippi, to me that's understandable when you're talking about the era of civil rights. You're talking about the time in which Dr. Howard was there. And then he left Mississippi and went to Chicago. So a lot of blacks left Mississippi and went due north.
It should, you know, could be pointed. I added to that that Howard, he's known to some specialists. He was known. There were a couple people who wrote the two best books, one named Charles Payne on the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement. And they have a lot in there about Howard. However, he was a national figure as well. And if any of you have access to a thing called ProQuest, where you can search newspaper articles, you can find Howard's name coming up in Chicago papers, in Philadelphia papers, black papers, though. He's not breaking it into the white papers. So he is well known nationally among African Americans. So he's not just a local figure in that sense. I was going to say something else related to that, but my memory escapes me. Well, one example of how well he is known is the Chicago Defender, which is the leading black newspaper in the country, puts him number one on their honor roll of African Americans who had done the most to advance civil rights. He is the head of the leading black national medical association. Howard is the equivalent of the AMA. He is the head of the leading black business organization, the National Negro Business League. So he has national reach even before the Emmett Till case comes in. But whites really are not noticing him so much. Even in Mississippi, it's interesting. They would have these rallies. In Mississippi, in Mound Bayou, they would get all the Howard would get all the bands from all the black schools. They'd go down the street with Thurgood Marshall and Mahalia Jackson, and they'd shut down Highway 61, a very famous highway for anyone that knows about the history of the blues, as it went through Mound Bayou. Oh, it was there. And you look at the white papers in Mississippi, and they're hardly even mentioning it. Like, gee, they shut down the main highway here. Why aren't you guys mentioning this? So he's sort of regarded almost as an oddity, as a kind of little bit of a nuisance. And for a long time, they ignore him. When things heat up, they really go after him. So that's interesting in a way that this is a black movement when we're talking about civil rights in Mississippi and largely nationally. Not like the 60s where you have all these whites coming down to Mississippi to help out. There's nothing like that going on. So it's a little bit more insular in that sense.
Right. And there was a parallel between black and white publications across the country that prevailed for a very long time. I sort of wound up getting educated about this from some friends at the Black Writers Guild who, wanted to make it very clear to me that there was a very big difference in what it is, because I told them I'd observed as a child that there was one black newspaper in the New York, New Jersey area that I remembered, but that did not know how to put that in context, and they tried to help me with that to understand that that there was a need for an entirely other basically not even necessarily network, but an entirely other level of literature when it came to news. Because of exactly what you're talking about, where a significant event could occur, but they could choose to ignore it, in the white media, so to speak, because they didn't want to empower it. And therefore, the only way you were going to find out about something like that was through these black newspapers, which did communicate with one another in various parts of the country and on and on, etc. So there was an absolute need for the parallel at that point in time, and some would argue that today there is still a need for it, but because a great many stories, the way they are covered, are not covered properly by the mainstream media. But then again, a lot of us have those arguments about history and the goings on of today not being properly covered by the mainstream media as is. I urge you guys to listen to me tomorrow night in the first hour to hear about what I have to say about recent events, because I'm seeing a little bit of feedback right now. And no, I don't think it's appropriate to discuss the past few days' events right now. That's not what the focus of the show is, but you can tune in tomorrow and we'll talk about that. And I'll probably lose my temper, unlike tonight. So anyway, be prepared for that. So I'm going to get us ready for a little break here, because I think it's appropriate. Professor Beto mentioned that, you know, at a certain point, Dr. Howard winds up in Chicago. Now, I'd like to talk about that and, what level of threat he was living under, given the amount of things that he was doing. Like I said, still, I don't think there are a great many figures like this that I've ever heard about in the South at this time period. Not even remotely close. I don't know. He seems rather unique to me. Again, it might be through my ignorance that I don't know about it. But then again, until people do the kind of work that both Professors Beto, would it be Professors Beto? I think that's how we would pluralize that, did here, that we would not necessarily know about T.R.M. Howard. And I urge you guys again to get the book. I will provide you with the Amazon and the publisher's links in order to go purchase it if you'd like. I know a couple of you have already ordered the book, and certainly I'm sure the professors here are grateful that you will be getting it and reading it. Take a look at the work that they put into it. It is a remarkable piece of work, and I think is absolutely valuable for the study of American history in general, but certainly completely indisposable as a resource when it comes to African-American history. Anyway, that's just my opinion. In the next hour, I'd like to get into Dr. Howard's move into Chicago and really get into a treatment of that, because we didn't really cover it except really quickly last time. So stick around, guys. The Ocelli Effect will be right back.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. The brilliant author of The War State brings you exclusive reports about the big changes upcoming in the markets. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
News, entertainment, and more. You will learn something, children's. Ocelli.com.
You're listening to Ocelli.com Radio Network, the alternative's alternative.
We should learn from our relatively recent history, my brother. That's where I'm coming from. I say all power to the people.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media.
The second hour of the Ocelli Effect beginning now. Yes, we are running slightly late if you're on the live stream. Of course, if you're on the podcast, you won't notice. So that's that. Anyway, it is Monday, and I have both Professors Beto with me, Professor Dave, who I dubbed the last time. And apparently you guys in emails and stuff have decided that that works, and he's fine with it. So there you go. Plus his wife, Linda Beto, who is also a professor, both of them PhDs. You know, I didn't even ask what their PhDs are in. I should probably do that at some point. But I was so anxious to get right into the topic of T.R.M. Howard. Again, Dr. Howard is a fascinating figure in American history. Certainly one that is relevant to African American history, but I find him to be a remarkable figure that I don't know, just reading about the man, I happen to appreciate him. His courage, his intelligence, his ethical behavior, as far as I'm concerned, his ethics when it comes to his work ethic as well as other things. It's interesting. He's not, you know, a squeaky clean character for the most part for a lot of people, but an extremely strong and interesting individual. I like him, to be honest with you. He's one of the more likable people that I've studied historically through one book, and the one book that they do have out there on this man. You know, once again, by the way, we were talking during the break, and I don't have the book in front of me. I should have went and got it, but I didn't have time because I wasted time during the break. But the fact is that there's some interesting blurbs on there, some support, and I'm telling you now, look, you guys hear me talk to a lot of authors about their books, and I say to you, okay, you know, here's where you can get their book. You don't often hear me recommend that you read a book necessarily. Of the hundreds of authors I've spoken to, right, less than half of them do I say, look, I highly recommend this book. Well, in this case, I highly recommend this book. So you guys know that. I think that this is required reading to understand a great many things and put them in perspective regarding our collective history, quite frankly, in this country. If you want to understand a lot of things that are going on today and really understand some of the relevant pieces of the very recent history, I think you need to read this book. Anyway, so we talked during the break, and we did lead out of the last hour by saying, you know, there was a migration by Dr. Howard. But before we go there, and we talk about the migration of many people going north from Mississippi, let's talk about what, you know, because last time I asked Professor Dave if it was because of the threats, and I didn't feel as though he very strongly said that that's what it was that caused Dr. Howard to move. Now, I did some other reading on this and found that there's some other opinions out there that that was the only reason why he moved. I don't know this for certain. I certainly am not well enough studied and haven't done the research that either of the professors, Beto, have done. But I'd like to talk about what set into motion the migration, if you will, of Dr. Howard, because there was an incident which occurred with his wife and a few other things that are mentioned in some other places. And in fact, both professors Beto did mention this in the book. Not sure who wrote which line necessarily, but how about if we address that now and talk about a move north, because his story doesn't end in Mississippi. So with that, I'd like to turn it back over to you guys.
Well, this is, you know, something we struggled with. There are different theories as to why he left. Some say it's a combination of different things. I think his wife played a role in this, in the sense that she was from Los Angeles. She came from Riverside, California, Los Angeles area, came from a well-off black family, well-established, and Mississippi was like another world to her. Yeah, there was a lot of discrimination in Los Angeles, but it was really nothing like this. Her health was not good. In fact, her son told us, or their son told me, that when Howard died, he thought that, you know, he wasn't sure who had died yet. He thought, you know, it's got to be his mother, because she would had a series of health problems. And was also in Mississippi, was, you know, was slapped around by a police officer. And we interviewed a gentleman who knew that police officer. And I asked him, well, did this happen? And he was quite explicit. Yes, it did. And sometimes you got to do that N-word to the ends. He said that to me. And I was like, okay, you know, can I get you on tape? No. But she was slapped around. And, you know, enough of this already. I think that there were other things possibly that fit into this. He saw economic opportunity in Chicago. People have called the south side of Chicago a suburb of Mississippi because blacks in Mississippi went predominantly there. So they replicated their communities there. There were organizations that catered to them. So he goes to Chicago. There are a lot of people that know about Dr. Howard. And I've interviewed quite a few of them just randomly that had heard of him, that knew about him because of that Mississippi connection. He also had some political ambitions. He was going to run for Congress, and you ain't going to do that in Mississippi in 1956 if you're a black man. You know, you got whole counties where there isn't a single black voter. I think that there was a combination of factors, but I definitely think the fact that his family was being threatened and his wife was being threatened is undeniable.
Mm. And let me add to that, when he got to Chicago, this is a statement he made, and this can help understand his look on it. He said, "I far rather side with McCarthy, who think there's a communist under every bed, than with Senator Eastland, who thinks there should be a Negro dangling from every rope."
Mm.
Who haven't you alienated with that statement? I mean, he would say things like that. People say, "Well, why can you work with Joe McCarthy?" And he was not a McCarthyite by any means at all. He's a little bit of a subversive in that way. But he said, "I'll work with him rather than this Democrat in Mississippi who I know well, Jim Eastland, who chaired the Judiciary Committee, I'll work with someone like that." And so he moved into the Republican Party in a big way, tried to make a career as a black Republican, a politician there in the immediate aftermath of coming in to Chicago.
And as a short note, when we're talking about these days, there was a migration of blacks out of the South. Mississippi, they went due north to Chicago. Alabama, due north to Detroit. And Georgia, due north to Washington, D.C. and Virginia.
Hmm. Yeah, because, you know, it's an interesting thing because we're talking about the late 60s to the 1970s, right, where this migration was really happening a lot, or was it earlier than that?
Oh, no, it goes back really to, I'd say, shortly after the turn of the 20th century, you get the beginnings of it. You had the first black congressman elected since, in the North ever, in 1928 in Chicago, Oscar DePriest, who was a Republican.
Okay.
And you had it building and building over time, but definitely it accelerated after World War II. So when Howard comes in the late 50s, it is well underway. There are a lot of African-Americans who have come to Chicago and are becoming something of a political force, although the local machine there is doing best to kind of neutralize them as a political force.
Yeah, see, because where I come to awareness in life is in the 1970s, right? And what my father taught me to read with was the newspapers, okay? And so I knew, quite frankly, that there was, certain areas in the North that had definitely been established as black areas, so to speak. And I was aware of this as a child. I wasn't aware of what it meant or how that happened. But, for me, I was in the New York, New Jersey area, right? So I knew about an entire, community that was contained within, Newark, New Jersey. I knew about an entire area that was contained in Asbury Park, New Jersey. I knew about various sections of New York City that were predominantly black. I knew that that there was a significant area of Chicago, which was certainly primarily black. I knew that Detroit had a significant area of it that was primarily black. Had no idea how it gotten that way. Didn't really give it much thought personally, but it was just sort of already there by the mid 70s for sure.
Well, let me give you a personal example of that migration. I had an uncle, my father's older brother, who left Alabama and gone off to service, a military man. And when he came back, whites started to treat him as they had before he left. And he said, "I cannot take it." And he moved his family to Detroit.
Right.
And again, that was, "I can't live like this any longer, and I don't want to be in prison." So he left.
Mm. So it just could be that the circumstance, if you had the wherewithal to get out of a circumstance that you found intolerable, I mean, who wouldn't move?
Well, the wages are high. You're going into Henry Ford as a, these are princely wages that is being paid by the automobile industry, for example, after World War II.
Mm.
You could just make a lot more money as an individual, working in these industrial jobs than you can make as a servant or something like that. So So, yeah, there are a lot of people stay behind because there are opportunities there, too. But there's a lure. It's an economic lure. So the sort of push and pull factors. The push factor is you got all this oppression. You got all this second-class citizenship. All this, you know, being called by your first name instead of your whether you're Mr. or Mrs. You got all that that's definitely driving people out. But there's a lure, too, that's just a human lure. There's opportunities here to go to where you can just make a lot more money and do a lot better economically.
So you've got a lot of very practical concerns outside of the racial ones even that could be a draw for somebody to go. And that's true even today, by the way, that wages are higher north of where I am, you know, but also so are your living expenses. You know, it's actually the reason why I'm further down south than I ever thought I would be. Because it's just the living expenses are lower here. It's that simple. You know, again, so there's that plus, as Dr. Beto stated there, or should I say Professor Beto instead of Professor Dave, had stated there, you know, there is this element of returning home from having served in the military. And that's a significant number of individuals across the country, certainly. But when they came home, you know, why would you want to then end up in a situation where you've just gone and served a country that still allows you to be treated in a certain way if you have the wherewithal to move your family elsewhere? I would, you know, just practical thoughts here. So there's that element of it, but do we know, is there documentation that that demonstrates that Dr. Howard specifically had an increase of threats, or was there anything outside of the incident with his wife, which obviously would be moving enough, and I've been married a couple of times, I would certainly be propelled to move elsewhere. If that circumstance could be remedied by changing my geographical location, and my wife had been treated in such a way by the police, and it was acceptable, you know, in an area where it was I was choosing to live, I'm sure that I would be persuaded to move, okay, quickly. There's that element of it, but, I mean, is there any increase in threats against him or an uptick in the potential for violence, you know, because this is years after the Till case, where I would think that would have probably provoked a lot of backlash for Dr. Howard, and that might have increased the level of threats. But years after that is when this move is made. So is there anything we know about that from either one of you?
Well, it really wasn't years after that. It was less than a year after Till's murder.
Oh, it was.
He left. He left, and he kind of took time to leave. But he basically, by mid-1956, he was in Chicago. Oh, yeah, definitely, to your question, the threat level is increased dramatically after the Supreme Court decision in 54 ordering integration of schools. Howard's theory was that if we can knock Mississippi out, if we can integrate the schools there, the rest is going to follow. And that's very reasonable because that's where segregation was the most severe. So Howard and his supporters are actually sending people out, parents out. Well, they're not sending them out, they're helping him. Parents are going and petitioning school districts saying, look, we want our kids to be in integrated schools. Well, these petitions are found by whites. The names are published in newspapers. People are harassed. And that movement is beaten down severely. So by that point, there are threats against Howard more and more. And then after the Till case, the press goes ballistic. A lot of whites had praised Howard in the 40s and 50s because he was seen as a guy that was, you know, pulling it up by his own bootstraps, doing all these great businesses. And he had become a threat. So the leading newspaper in the state, the Jackson Daily, whatever, the main paper there, is attacking him and said, this man is a loudmouth. Somebody should shut this guy up. They're calling him public enemy number one. You're getting things like that that's read all over the state of Mississippi. And there's one interesting incident that shows how severe things were. Howard was in a meeting in Mississippi. He had to get back home, and people told him, look, it's too dangerous now. And so someone was there who happened to have a connection with a funeral a parlor. There were a lot of blacks who had, businesses related to that. Mm-hmm. And the guy said, okay, well, we're going to get a coffin for you. We're going to drill some holes in it, and we're going to get you out of here. And they put him in the coffin, and then they put him in the back of the hearse and drove him out to safety. So that sounds like an incredible story, but we confirmed that from multiple sources that did, in fact, happen. That's how severe things got.
And when you say recorded, it was recorded in Jet and the Chicago Daily Defender, and they quoted some of the things that were saying, talking about the Negro Underground organized by Dr. Howard. They also told the story of Arrington High, who wrote again about Dr. Howard being put in this casket to escape.
Yeah, could I say something about Arrington High, who is a totally unknown name, and someone should write a biography of him? He is the bizarrest character ever. He is he writes a gossip rag called The Eagle Eye in Mississippi. He gets a big black readership, so he's talking about who's sleeping with who, that kind of thing. Then he goes after segregation, and he says, well, the whites don't seem to be white men in this state don't seem to be bothered by bedroom integration, meaning they're patronizing black prostitutes. So why are they so bothered by school integration? And he would name names.
Ooh.
He was this bizarre character who had this little newsletter that he'd hawk on the street and say, I can't afford it now. He says, you got to have this. And he was eventually smuggled out of the state. Howard helped organize an escape from the state mental asylum, and he was organized out of the state in a casket. And there's a picture of him in Jet Magazine, posing in the casket that he escaped from. And High was just this really colorful guy that had this little newsletter, and he'd go out there and he'd attack the white establishment, and his literacy wasn't that high. He'd misspell names, and it was invective after invective. So Howard had a lot of invective, but High was even more so. But no one knows about him, but somebody should write about it.
Somewhere there's got to be a collection of those newsletters preserved,
FBI
right?
has them. He has a fat FBI file.
Of course the FBI has it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I have to laugh at that. But, I never think of that where it's like, somewhere they should preserve this stuff. I should remember that all subversives are – and I should know that from my own personal experience, by the way, because I happen to know that writing a letter to President Reagan when you're 12 years old talking about nuclear disarmament gets your FBI file opened, by the way. That's just from my own personal experience. I just, recount that to my listeners. that is how you do that. That's one way, anyway. But either way, anybody who's considered subversive winds up with a file, and they do extensively, keep track of your little publications. You're guaranteed, if you do an independent publication and you are considered subversive, you're guaranteed at least one subscription, and that is from the federal government. So, keep that in mind, as an incentive. That guy sounds like a really interesting character. I wonder if somebody will take that up, though, and write about him. But back to Dr. Howard and his migration to Chicago. This marks an interesting change, and I'd like to spend the remainder of the show kind of on that, if you guys don't mind, because this is really interesting. You would think that, again, this would make him a whole lot more noticeable to the entire establishment, if he's in Chicago. I mean, later on, as Professor Beto noted, he would have the opportunity to be seen on TV and things like this. later on, and yet I don't see, again, a lot of film of the man. I don't, outside of the audio that that you've shared with me, there's not a whole lot floating around. It just seems like there's just not much that has been preserved here regarding this man. And yet he did a remarkable amount of work and touched a lot of people's lives. So if you wouldn't mind, I would like to hear more about his, you know, journey to Chicago and, outside of the attempted run for Congress there, what else it is he was doing. Because I think that's a remarkable story as well.
Well, before we start out on his work there in building the Medica Center and treating blacks on the South Side, I want to ask the question as to why is it that we don't know or don't hear more about him in Chicago? And my opinion is that William L. Dawson had Chicago locked in. He had the machine of Chicago. And so Howard was an outsider. He was coming in from somewhere else. And I think that is why we don't hear him taking over and being as successful, especially politically, in Chicago as he attempted to. And I think it's because of Dawson.
Mm.
As Dawson was the black congressman, they called him William the Silent. He was the black Democratic congressman who represented the South Side and was a key player in initially really helped to propel forward the Daily Machine, and later became kind of a subordinate of the machine, but a brilliant political operator who knew how to use patronage money and spread it around. And if you challenged him in an election, as someone said, he'd swat you like a fly. Mm-hmm. And he was tremendously powerful. Now, Howard was interviewed. I've seen examples of that, but unfortunately, they'd be local stations. And I call these local stations, and guess what? You know, as a matter of course, they destroy all that stuff. So very little has been. In fact, I'd love to see examples preserved from those Chicago years of him being interviewed on tape or on video. We have a fair amount, some during the Till period in Mississippi, but not very much in Chicago. Not that it didn't exist; it just was local and it was didn't survive.
Well, no, that's a good objective point. There is that local stations were not necessarily accustomed to preserving their archives in the '60s, for sure. Network affiliates were a little different, but if you were an independent station, you would reuse your tape, quite honestly, for different purposes. And they didn't have a lot of storage either, which it was kind of a little more of a bulky affair than it would be today or even two decades or three decades ago. We're not talking about VHS tapes here. These were pretty large things that they would have had to preserve. And so they didn't preserve everything. That's true, but still, I see it as kind of strange that more has not been preserved. But anyway, it is notable that you're talking about this Dawson, who is part of the Democratic machinery in Chicago, and obviously Dr. Howard running as a Republican, certainly was dealt with. It wouldn't have mattered what his ethnicity was. It seems like he would have just been dealt with about the same way had he come in from outside from anywhere. But maybe it was made explicitly worse by the fact that he was also black. I don't know. But quite frankly, I guess all those things are factors. Anyway, I'd like to get more into this, though, because still there's a remarkable amount of names that we do know very well that encountered Dr. Howard even after his move north and after all what he had accomplished in Mississippi. And still, again, I point you guys back to the discussion where we were talking about the service stations in Mississippi and how that was handled and the rather intelligent strategy that was employed by Dr. Howard and others in order to create the desired results from some of the bigger business elements there in the South. Kind of a different atmosphere, though, going to Chicago. So But even still, it seems as though he encountered and influenced a great many people when he went north. So I'd like to get into a little bit of that now.
Well, I think because of Howard's personality, he did a lot of things. And so I think his attention would change. When he got to Chicago, he started traveling to Africa and big game hunting. And so he changed consistently. He always changed. And I think that's one reason why we don't hear a lot of him, because he didn't just do politics. He didn't just do medicine. He had other interests as well.
And certainly he was a bit of a Renaissance man. And I think I mentioned last time you had asked him about Emmett Till in the 1970s. He'd probably tell you about it, but he didn't dwell on it. He really was always moving on to a new project. Oh, he's like the Andy Hardy, you know, character, you know, in the old movies. Let's put on a show. Let's do something new. Let's you know. He would always have a new idea. But he was certainly well known to some key national figures there, such as Malcolm X. Malcolm X would come and ask Dr. Howard for support, and they were a lot alike, really, especially after Malcolm X broke with the Nation of Islam. Howard headed a fund to raise money for Malcolm X's children after Malcolm X was assassinated. He was the guy in Chicago that ran that fund. And Operation Push, Jesse Jackson's group, was founded in the Safari Room, which was in Howard's basement where he had all of his stuffed animals, where he'd gotten on safaris to Africa. So he was also known for his New Year's Eve parties, where you would get all the black elite. It was the place to go. He had an orchestra. He had his own signature recipes that he would serve to people, you know, and so forth. So he had that persona as well. So he was a well-known figure. In some ways, his wife was as well-known because she was very active in a black organization that's still around called the Lynx, which is for elite black women. And they did a lot of things, including support civil rights, but also various charities. Yeah, and she was a major leader in that. So she really flourished in Chicago that she had in ways that she had not been able to flourish in Mississippi as a leader in her own right.
Mm. Well, I wonder about that, too, if that might have been part of the impetus for her to move, you know, for them to move, I should say, because, you know, not only would you have limitations and obstacles if you were a black man in the South, as Dr. Howard was, but, I mean, as a black woman in the South, it seems to me, now maybe I'm misinformed, but it seems to me at this point in time, you would have been even more marginalized as a person. I hate to put it that way, but, I mean, you know, she would have had less opportunity to be active in the general sense, in the South, it seems like to me. Now, is that true, or am I misunderstanding this?
No, that's probably absolutely true. I think one of the biggest differences is that she came from an area where her father ran a newspaper, and so she had funds and had prestige. And she goes to Mississippi, and you're talking about a time when Mississippi, you're talking about abject poverty. I mean, absolute poverty. And so to see that and to live within it and to be a part of it was shocking to her. And I think what Howard did was, after he had worked for several years and had built a reputation, then he considered his wife and moved to Chicago.
Mm. Well, yeah, there could have been a lot
of
considerations.
She was important in his rise. There's no doubt about it. He would have risen otherwise. But when he's in California as a young medical student, she was able to introduce him to all these people in the local black elite. That is, a poor boy from Kentucky, he would have had a little bit more difficulty getting an entree to people like that. And they accepted him. They liked him and so forth. But she opened the door for him in a lot of ways early on.
So it could be that that she opened the door for him, and perhaps he had opened her eyes to a world of things that maybe she didn't know about as far as the negative goes anyway in the South, given that she's now looking at abject poverty, which she would not have observed from her position in California previously, you know, which at one point is an education, but at another point is probably a heavy weight to have to deal with if you're not accustomed to it, certainly. So, I mean, all these things could have been a factor. So I can see why. Some people would point to the incident with the police, but also there's probably a great many other factors that, unless we were privy to conversations in a marriage, okay, we might not know the whole of the reasoning for this move. But it did happen, and as we were saying, though, you know, I think there's other figures, you know, outside of Malcolm X, there's other people outside of Jesse Jackson. There's other people whose names you'd know. That the two of them encountered through these parties, through this socialization, through their activities. I think we're almost skipping over one of his primary concerns, though, which is medicine. And that is something that is continuous through his story here, where, yeah, his focuses are changing, his interests are changing. But medicine seemed to prevail as a consistent interest. Wouldn't you guys like to address that a little bit?
Well, when we were researching, the thing we kept coming up with was that he was an excellent surgeon. They talked about the abilities of his hands and how well he did. So the one thing about medicine is that he was not a mediocre doctor.
Right.
He was at the top of his game, and everybody knew it.
And he ended up running the largest privately owned black, largest private black owned medical facility in Chicago, which was sort of named after his hospital in Mississippi. It was called the Friendship Medical Center, and it was a place that had a lot of. Anticipated the kind of patient-friendly care that we see now. You know, he had color TV sets. He had posters of Angela Davis. He had animals that he killed in his safaris. They had waterfalls. You know, and this is in the middle of a very poor part of the south side of Chicago. So he had this very large medical facility there that did everything. Including psychological counseling, you name it. So he had a big impact as a doctor. It's amazing when you think about it. He had this, and then he would go on these safaris to Africa, and he'd go to Kenya or Tanzania, and we got letters back from people. We wrote, looked into this, and what he was doing is giving instructions to medical students in Africa. He was spending all this time doing this. In addition to going out into these safaris, he used to boast he was the leading American black big game hunter in the world, which probably in some circles doesn't go over well today, but he was proud of that. And frankly, a lot of local African Americans were. Emmett Till's mother was a school teacher in Chicago, and she'd bring her kids in to look at the safari room and hear Howard's stories about all these safaris. And they were very proud of it.
Well, right, and it's an interesting thing too. You know, I don't. Was it publicly known at the time that he was instructing medical students in Africa as well when he went over there? I mean, because that seems to be something that should have been publicized back here.
No, it was not. It was not known, and I found out about it, or we found out about it. I think together we looked. We just looked at names of people. It was mentioned that he'd visited some doctor or something in the social pages. So we looked up this guy and found him and wrote back a very nice description of this. And went, wow, how does this guy find the time for all of this?
And he brought people back from Africa and paid to have them educated.
Yeah, including a woman named Ethiopia Begale, who, after the coup in Ethiopia, was brought out by Dr. Howard. Her father was high in the government. We interviewed her, and she called, you know, she says, my father. You know, she was very mad at Jesse Jackson because when Howard died, Jesse Jackson didn't tell her right away. They were at a conference. He said, he didn't tell me my father had died. So, you know, you have, he does that kind of thing as well.
Well, it seems to me like he was, for lack of better terminology, you know, the idea that when you are given the help from someone else to reach up for something that you may not have been able to reach up for without their assistance, it seems to me as though some people realize and show their gratitude by doing the very same thing for someone else that might not otherwise have that same opportunity. And I don't know. I get the sense from reading from reading your work, but also doing some other research, that this seemed to be his general attitude, that, since he had been given opportunity, he wanted to return that to others who maybe would not have had the same opportunity, if they were not given that helping hand. Does this sound like an accurate portrayal in your estimation, Dr. Beto?
Well, I think that helps, but you have to go to who the person is. And let me give you an example.
Sure.
When he had patients that were poor and he'd go in and operate on them, he would give them a bag of seeds so they could plant a garden and feed themselves. And so I think that goes to not only someone helping him and him helping someone else, but also it goes to the core of the individual, who he is or was.
Mm. No, that is, you know, obviously it's something that was, do we have any idea where this sort of, because look, it's very easy to be embittered and to maybe not necessarily be a giving person if you have suffered difficult circumstances early in life, right? No matter who you are, I mean, this is not just relevant to the concept of abuses based on the fact that you're in the South and, you know, you're in the unfriendly South given the tone of your skin. But anybody who comes from circumstances which are hard, sometimes they're a bit bitter. They're not there with the idea of being supportive and kind to their fellow human being necessarily. It doesn't mean that they're bad people, but in some cases they don't all. I don't know. I find it rare actually that someone who escapes those circumstances is as generous. I don't know what other word I could use for the examples I'm hearing here and for what it is that I understand. You know, the man certainly gave of himself, his time, his resources, his skills. It seems like across the board, one way or another, whether it was indeed exciting the imagination of children or it was giving assistance to medical students in Africa or bringing them here to be educated or assisting poor people who he had operated on. I mean, it just seems like across the board, this was certainly part of him. And I wonder what that is. You know, do we know what really inspired that in him, or is it just something that just I don't know, was sort of given to him by his creator? You know, what is your opinion on that?
I don't know. I'm inclined to believe that is just who he was, because when we look at the totality of his life, you never saw him change. People loved him in Mississippi. They loved him in Chicago. So I just think that's who he was myself. And when we looked at the incidences of, you know, his early childhood and growing up, and sure, he had some hard times. And not only that, he saw some horrible things in the racist South. But, again, he did not choose to be hard-hearted and selfish and me, me, me. He shared, he helped, and he worked. And right. I think that was another thing, too, that provoked us to really want to write about it.
Yeah, I interviewed a gentleman who it was his doctor and really knew him very well and said a lot of things about her, gave me very honest, you know, his flaws, and there were many, and his virtues and so forth. But he sort of sat back for a minute, and here's a doctor in Chicago, black doctor, and he knew Howard well. He said, I never heard the man say a racist thing, ever. And he said, he sort of said back, isn't that amazing? And so there was not, he was not a man to dwell on the past, which is a little unfortunate for us, because we would have liked to have seen more examples of him saying, well, I did this and I did that, and here are the people that influenced me. And he would occasionally tell stories like that, but he really did not dwell on his past and grievances. You know, he was not a man to go, you know, and do the airing of grievances. He was saying, what am I going to do next?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting hallmark here, is the idea that he was interested in progress as opposed to dwelling on the negativity. You know, obviously he recognized it, he knew it, he had lived it, but didn't apparently make it a focal point of his life in that. Because, look, again, frankly, if the man had said some racist things, I wouldn't find it to be a flaw. I would find it to be a natural reaction to the fact that you had been shown hate and you reflected it back. It wouldn't be something that I would hold against him personally. I would say, look, you can't blame the man for having a bit of hate in him. But from what I can understand, nobody could demonstrate that, at least through nothing that anybody could find, you know, in the evidentiary record. There is there's no way to show that this man was hateful in any way.
He's not a Pollyanna either, though.
No, not a Pollyanna.
He knows things are bad, and he speaks out against the injustice, but he doesn't kind of – it doesn't dominate him in the sense of dominate some people.
Yeah. I think another thing, too, he knew that money's power. And so he was about making money so he could do some things. And one of the things, of course, was to be the first swimming pool for blacks in the state of Mississippi. When we were researching, we could not find one that predated Dr. Howard.
Right. And I mean, the man was diverse when it came to these things, too, because we had talked about in the first show. I mean, he had actually created a beer garden. You know, there was a zoo, right? There was a whole bunch of different things, and plus he was still a member of various organizations, but those organizations' agendas didn't exactly rule over him. It seems as though nothing did outside of his own desire to really just improve what it was he knew needed improving, one way or another, and it seems as though it's a natural vocation for him to have gone into medicine, given his character. I really truthfully wish that we could find a way to figure out what the roots of that truly were, because it should be replicated. This idea, this attitude, this ethical concern. Yes, I realize that also a man is still a man. We're not talking about, you know, again, the angelic figure all the way around, but I find it extremely impressive that that at no time anybody can demonstrate that, you know, there was resentment that was overbearing in any of his presentations. You know, he spoke to, and when I listen to him speak, interesting the way he speaks, too, because quite often I'm used to hearing civil rights figures when they speak. They're mostly preachers is what I get to hear from, and they sound like it, right? He doesn't sound like a preacher, right? But the, you know, and there's a strength in the way a preacher speaks, the cadence, the melodic tones that come from, you know, somebody like Dr. King and the way he spoke, the way that, many others happen to, utilize a very interesting kind of a strength in their cadence and so on and so forth. His way of speaking, to me, was very businesslike, very direct, but very clear, very concise, and very much to the point. And I find it remarkable the way he spoke as well. I wish I could figure out a way to give a solid presentation on just his speeches, to be honest with you. But perhaps we'll leave that for the listeners to explore. And as we come close to the end here, is there anything that either of you thinks that we have neglected to mention? Professor Dave, I got to rely on you because you've been here for both shows to figure this out. But, I mean, do you think we've missed mentioning something that is key here when it comes to, people's need to understand the book? And also, I'd like you to formally talk about the book a little bit here since we are almost at the end. And I want to thank both of you for taking this time with me tonight to do so. I believe that this is a time well spent because we are allowing people to be enlightened by an individual who is not as well recognized historically as he should be. I make that point repeatedly, and I stand by it. There is not enough written about this man. There's not enough known about this man by the general public. I feel as though he is absolutely essential, should be added to any curriculum on American history during his time period for sure. And if the study is about African American history, I cannot see how he has been redacted from the syllabus thus far. So, actually, if my opinion is worth anything, and apparently, Dr. Cornel West has an opinion about this book as well, but my opinion here is that, there is no way that, your book should not be added to the canon of required reading when it comes to African American studies, for any course that is, well worth its, its time for the student who is to take it and the professor who is to teach it. So that's the way I leave it. But I turn it over to you to tell us if we have missed anything and also to remind people exactly of the title of the book, anything else you'd like to add in. Again, I'd like to start with Professor Dave because he was here for both conversations. But I'd like Professor Beto, Linda Beto, that is, to close out the show with her final thoughts. Because I didn't even get to the question about being an African American woman teaching in the South, which by the way, I invite you if you'd like to come on the show and just talk about that some night. I would love to do that as well, but you don't have to. Obviously, it's just an invitation. You can decline, but I would be grateful if you even agreed to do that. Anyway, Professor Dave, excuse me, please go ahead and tell us what we missed and tell us again about the book.
Well, it's called T.R.M. Howard, just like it sounds, Doctor, Entrepreneur, Civil Rights Pioneer. It is published by the Independent Institute, and we have a nice foreword by Jerry Mitchell, who's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist who's covered a lot of big stories in Mississippi involving civil rights. And like as you mentioned, we have blurbs, positive blurbs on the book from Cornel West, Julian Bond, Juan Williams, we have some quotable things in there from people like Dick Gregory, who knew Dr. Howard. So again, you can get it at the Independent Institute, or you can get it off of Amazon. Just briefly, the only thing I would say, again, is to stress that Howard is a unique individual, but he's part of this larger tradition that really gets short shrift. For a lot of the reasons he gets short shrift, of self-help, of entrepreneurship, of mutual aid. There were a lot of blacks who built these vibrant institutions, mutual aid organizations and so forth, and who were all over the place in Mississippi and were tremendously important in black history, providing the necessary foundation for civil rights.
Another thing to mention here really quickly is, we've often heard about the concept of economic empowerment being discussed publicly by black leaders, quite honestly. It seems as though Dr. Howard was well ahead of their rhetoric that I got to hear in the 70s and 80s regarding how investment in the community would be the intelligent thing to do and all of that. I find that to be a lesson that has not been included as well here. But perhaps we can discuss it another day. With that, yes, Professor Beto, please, by all means, if you wouldn't mind giving us your final thoughts or anything that you believe that we've overlooked, more than happy. Go ahead.
Well, by me not being with you when David had it the other day, the book won the Gold Award for the best biography in the United States by independent publishers. So we're very proud of the Independent Institute for that. Mm. And Dr. Howard, it was an interesting man. We enjoyed writing about him. I learned more about the blacks in the Mississippi Delta. And for him to go in and do as much as he did, I think it's just remarkable. And he is somebody that people should know about. To be an African-American, I was trained at the University of Alabama, which is predominantly white, and I taught at white schools, and I'm also teaching at an HBCU. So to answer your question, being a black female teaching both black students and white students as well, I love telling them about information they've not yet heard about. That's what education is all about, and it just gets me excited. My students say, Dr. Beto, you love this stuff, and I say, absolutely, I do.
Well, that, you know what, and that is always the enthusiasm of the instructor is a key element, I think, in exciting the imagination and the intelligence of the student. So you know that is an absolutely wonderful thing to hear, and I'm so very happy to have had both of you on the show tonight. But again, you know, I wasn't trying to, for that one email again, which bothered me to no end, I was not overlooking Linda Beto in the equation. It's just that I had already spoken with Professor Dave. So, you know, I don't always go to try and get both authors of a book. It wasn't like it was purposeful to ignore his wife, Linda Beto, who is also a professor, PhD. That's the other thing, by the way, just last question really quickly. You know, and again, I advise that you guys get this book, especially if you're as woefully uninformed about T.R.M. Howard as I was before getting the book. I think you will learn a lot, and it's a remarkable story for a lot of reasons, and I think it is exactly the thing that should be taught to a great many students for a great many reasons. But what exactly are your doctorates in, each of you, if you don't mind?
Well, mine is in U.S. history from University of Wisconsin, and I wrote about tax revolt during the Great Depression for my dissertation. But anyway, I'm sort of a guy that moves on to very different topics, so you can't get much of a greater contrast between that topic and this one.
Right. That's for sure.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just giving you a space there. Go ahead.
Yes, my PhD comes from the University of Alabama, premier institution here in the state of Alabama. And my concentrations were in political science, leadership, and criminal justice. So I teach in both areas. And in fact, right now I am starting a criminal justice program for Stillman College.
Mm. That's you know what, I like your area of study. See, I knew she was the one with the more complex area of study. So, Professor Dave, I love you, man. Don't feel bad. I just find Professor Beto to be the more interesting character among the two of you. But you are a great guy, man.
To
I appreciate
come
you.
To terms with that reality. It's fine with me.
All right. Well, again, though, the book is T.R.M. Howard, and it has a red cover, just so you guys know. And I know it because I accidentally picked off the wrong red book last time when I got on the show here off of my bookshelf. But it is something that I look forward to handing over to my child as part of their essential learning library. And I certainly hope that you, the listener, will do the same. So, again, I thank both Professors Howard. I, again, think that's how we pluralize that. But then again, I've only got a high school education. So the dumbest guy in the room is telling you, please go get this book and learn along with me. So the Ocelli Effect is finished for this particular Monday night. And do appreciate you for tuning in. Remember this at all times, no matter who you are, where you are. Not only do I hope you're well, but remember,